This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Request for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for March 10th, 2014. As usual, the federal courts and the Internal Revenue Service have given us plenty to talk about. So let's get started. The first of nine items this week discusses the IRS modification of procedures for accounting method changes for depreciation and disposition of assets. That's Revenue Procedure 2014-17, which is necessary in order to comply with and or take advantage of the new 263 tangible property regulations. Second, we're going to talk a little bit about the Form 8960 instructions and the fact that they're out, but they also apply for 2014, and some of the instructions in the instructions for Form 8960 are not applicable to 2013. They're only for 2014. Next, the IRS is allowed by a bankruptcy court to reduce a debtor's refund for repayment of the first-time home buyer credit because the repayment is as a tax, not as the repayment of a loan. Then the Large Business and International Division has updated a memorandum giving guidance to its agents on the information document request enforcement process, clarifying and adding one circumstance where the disciplinary rules will apply. Then an affirmation by the Fifth Circuit in an odd decision, Klamath Strategic Investment Fund, in which the Fifth Circuit upholds a decision of a district court that the partners may deduct certain operational expenses even though the partnership itself was engaged in a sham transaction. Now, that's contrary to everything that I thought I knew about the rules on deducting losses, that if the activity itself was not a profit-making activity, if the losses were disallowed because you had a sham transaction, then nobody would get to deduct any expenses either, but apparently the Fifth Circuit feels otherwise. Final regulations on healthcare coverage information reporting, and the good news there is that large employers can comply with Section 6055 and Section 6056 in a single report, and a fact sheet, which will be extremely helpful to employers, on the final Affordable Care Act information reporting regulations. Then, two developments, a video providing tax tips to same-sex married couples and an updated frequently asked questions on same-sex couples who are legally married under state law. Then a couple is not entitled to determine currently not collectible status themselves. Instead, their income will be determined by the Internal Revenue Service, averaging their income for the preceding 3 years, and their allowable expenses are determined by national and local collection standards. It doesn't matter what they are spending. What matters is what they are permitted to count as expenditures, and the IRS wants the difference between what they are permitted to count as expenditures and the calculated amount of their income. In the particular case we're talking about, it didn't help any that they moved $120,000 out of a savings account before they started negotiating with the Internal Revenue Service. And they represented that that $120,000 belonged to the taxpayer wife's mother, and they were effectively hiding it from Medicaid. That's called between a rock and a hard place, I think. Finally, the IRS has released an updated audit technique guide on farming operations. Those of you who have clients who are farmers must be interested in this 312-page audit technique guide. So there's a lot to do. Let's get started. Revenue Procedure 2014-17 modifies the procedures for accounting method changes for depreciation and disposition of assets. Final regulations published in September of 2013 provided guidance on the deduction and capitalization of tangible assets. Those final regulations included rules for depreciating or amortizing leasehold improvements and rules for accounting for property depreciated under Section 168. The final regulations generally apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2014, but do permit a taxpayer to apply them to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2012. In the alternative, taxpayers are permitted to apply provisions of the December 2011 temporary regulations to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2012, before January 1, 2014. There were some proposed regulations issued concurrently with the final regulations, which will, when finalized, modify the rules for general asset accounts and provide rules for accounting for partial or complete dispositions of MACRS property. Those proposed regulations will apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2014, but allow a taxpayer to rely on them for tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2012, and before January 1, 2014. Revenue Procedure 2011-14, as you know, provides the procedures by which a taxpayer may obtain automatic consent of the commissioner to change to a method of accounting described in its over 150 appendices. Revenue Procedure 2014-17 modifies the appendix of RevProc 2011-14 to provide additional changes in method of accounting that are consistent with the final and proposed regulations, specify an additional scope limitation that is inapplicable, waive a scope limitation in specified circumstances, remove a section because it is obsolete, and provide additional inapplicability provisions consistent with the final and temporary regulations. Specifically, Revenue Procedure 2014-17 describes the procedures a taxpayer should use to change 5 different methods of accounting, starting with a method of accounting for leasehold improvements in which the taxpayer has a depreciable interest, all the way to a method of accounting regarding disposition of an asset subject to a general asset account election. It also adds new automatic changes to the appendix of RevProc 2011-14, including taxpayer that wants to make a late partial disposition election for the disposition of a portion of an asset, a taxpayer that wants to revoke its general asset account election, a taxpayer that wants to make the partial disposition election specified in the proposed regulations, and a taxpayer that wants to change its method of accounting for leasehold improvements in which the taxpayer has a depreciable interest. So that's going to be, that is the last bit of guidance we needed, by the way, to fully apply the new repair regulations. So it's time to go to work on those now. Next, just a heads up that the instructions for Form 8960 include some instructions that are not applicable to the 2013 tax year. The IRS wanted to give us, the instructions are based on the final regulations. The IRS wanted to make them complete, give us instructions so that we could plan ahead for our clients. So we know what the instructions are for 2013 and 2014, even though all of the instructions that are issued as applicable to the form are not applicable to 2013. Just as an aside, one issue that is causing a lot of trouble is the interplay between income derived in the ordinary course of a trade or business and the Section 469(e)(1)(b) working capital rule. Confusion arises in situations when a partnership owns a corporation that is in the same trade or business as the partnership. In that circumstance, the partnership or an S corporation that owned a C corp is going to receive dividends even though the C corporation engages in the same trade or business as the partnership. The question is, are the dividends earned in the ordinary course of a trade or business, or are they investment income? In this circumstance, in the way the law is written, the Section 1411(c)(3) working capital rule will apply, even if you might say the dividends are derived in the ordinary course of a trade or business. Because Section 1411(c)(3) is cross-referenced to 469(e)(1)(b) and its regulations 1.469-2TC32i, and those provide only 6 ways in which something is derived in the ordinary course of a trade or business for purposes of Section 469, you're stuck with the Section 469 definition of what is an ordinary course of a trade or business for purposes of determining investment income under Code Section 1411. Even if you had case law, the case law is bound to predate the passage of Section 1411, so 1411(c)(3) is trumps. It will prevent taxpayers from getting those dividends out of net investment income unless the taxpayer in the odd situation would be a dealer in C Corporation stock. Next, and quickly, in a bankruptcy decision coming out of the Northern District of California, Dawn Bryan argued that the repayment of her first-time homebuyer tax credit was a general obligation which should have been expunged by her bankruptcy. The bankruptcy court said, however, that the debtor's obligation to repay the first-time homebuyer tax credit was a non-dischargeable tax. the credit was similar to, but in fact not alone. The crucial fact is, Congress imposed the obligation to repay the credit as a tax. Take a look at Code Section 36F1, which provides that if a home buyer takes the first-time home buyer tax credit, open quote, the tax imposed by this chapter shall be increased by 6 2/3% of the amount of such credit for each taxable year in the recapture period, close quote. So, while the new home buyer tax credit is like a loan in the sense that it has to be repaid, the obligation to repay is imposed as an increased tax. Rather than a general obligation, it is therefore not dischargeable under Section 523A1A of the Bankruptcy Code, and the IRS is entitled to collect it by offsetting it against any future refunds. Next, we have the Large Business and International Division updating its memorandum on how taxpayers and IRS agents are to deal with information document requests. You'll recall that back in 2013, the LB&I issued a memorandum imposing strict new rules on the timing of taxpayer response to information document requests. If a taxpayer doesn't respond timely, then there is a series of enforcement processes, beginning with first a delinquency. If the taxpayer doesn't respond within 30 days, then there's a delinquency notice, another 30 days, a pre-summons letter, another 30 days, a summons. So it's important that taxpayers and revenue agents agree on a schedule at the beginning of the engagement. The IDR, the rules, also specified that the information document request has to state a specific issue. There is, however, introduced in this latest revision an exception, and that exception is an IDR which is issued at the beginning of an examination that requests the basic books and records and general information about a taxpayer's business. That IDR is not subject to the requirement that it state a specific issue. All other IDRs must still state an issue so that the IRS agent cannot burden the taxpayer with a fishing expedition, and so that the taxpayer can narrow the work that they have to do to respond to the agent. In Klamath Strategic Investment Fund, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, notoriously not friendly to the Internal Revenue Service, has ruled that losses claimed by a partnership in a tax shelter transaction were not deductible, operational expenses incurred by the controlling partners were deductible. I'm not sure I quite understand how they manipulated their way through that, because my understanding has always been that if the activity itself was a sham, expenses incurred in connection with the activity would not be deductible. So I don't quite understand how you're able to balance that the losses claimed on a transaction are disregarded for lack of economic substance, while certain expenses incurred by the controlling partners were deductible. If the expenses were incurred in connection with the transaction that had no economic substance, how can the expenses be deductible? But you can satisfy your own curiosity here. It's an 11-page opinion. The opinion seems to rely heavily on the fact that the controlling partners, the individuals who are going to be allowed to deduct those expenses, were in fact in control of the partnership. I personally don't see how that makes any difference. But I don't always agree with the decisions of the federal courts, and they don't always agree with me. Next, final regulations on healthcare coverage information reporting. The good news is the final regulations provide for the use of a single combined form for reporting the information required under both Section 6055 and Section 6056. That's the reporting form to the government. The reporting to the employee is simplified by allowing the use of a reporting code, simply that the employee is covered on the W-2, along with the amount that the employer pays for the employee's coverage. Along with the final regulations, I think probably most interesting to a lot of us is the fact sheet, which the IRS published on, or the Treasury Department published on March the 5th, 2014. It is simply titled Fact Sheet, Final Regulations Implementing Information Reporting to Employers and Insurers Under the Affordable Care Act, jointly issued by the Department of Treasury and the Internal Revenue Service. The fact sheet explains in plain English the combined form for information reporting and the simplified option for employer reporting. Next, information release 2014-22, the IRS advising us that they have released a two-minute YouTube video to provide useful tax tips to same-sex married couples in order to help them file their federal income tax returns correctly for 2013. Of more interest, however, is the updated frequently asked questions on same-sex couples who are legally married under state law, originally issued November 20, 2013, updated March 6, 2014. This 11-page list of frequently asked questions should be the go-to guide for those who prepare tax returns for same-sex couples, and perhaps give a copy to your same-sex couple clients to help them understand exactly what the rules governing their ability to file joint returns or not, and the application of other federal rules to their joint returns will be. Then we have a couple not entitled to declare themselves currently not collectible. Troy Dalla and his wife had about $6,000 a month in income, and they told the IRS they had more than that in expenses. The IRS was perfectly happy with their income number, but reworked their expenses applying the national and local standard allowances. When you're negotiating with the Internal Revenue Service to get a break on collecting past due income taxes, you are subject not, they're going to consider not what you are spending, but what the national and local standard allowances will allow to be considered as what you can spend in any kind of, if you want the IRS to give you, cut you a break on your repayment of your tax liability. So Mr. and Mrs. Dalla were spending more than the national and local standard allowances. Plus, they'd had $120,000 in a savings account that they were holding for her mother to try to protect that from the Medicaid people. They just had a few problems convincing the Internal Revenue Service that they, in fact, did not have sufficient income to make any kind of a monthly payment on their past due tax obligation. So the IRS settlement officer's decision, carefully considered, by the way, there's quite a record of the IRS being very cooperative with the Dallas, but ultimately concluding that they had enough income to pay their allowable living expenses and still give the IRS money every month. Finally, this week, we have a 312-page audit technique guide for farmers. In addition to the general rules that apply to calculating the income tax liability of a farmer, what is income, what is deductible, determining the basis of assets, we have some crop-specific rules. Cotton, raisin grapes, general livestock, auction barns, grain farming, and finally, tobacco. Well, that's it, folks. It's a wrap for this week. As usual, our counsel is, stay safe.